Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Rob Brooks, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. Today, we're going to be discussing employment agreements, what they are, how to use them, and if you're already using them, ways that you can get the most bang for your buck. Additionally, we're going to talk about recent developments in this area and the cans and cannots when you're drafting an employment agreement. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, Tawny.
So, some of our listeners may already know you, Rob, but I always think it's helpful for our listeners to get a sense as to who you are, what you do at Verrill, and why people should be listening to the things that you have to say.
I've been at Verrill for almost 28 years in September, and during that time I have practice exclusively in the labor and employment area. And one of the things that I do a lot of is draft employment agreements, review employment agreements, and litigate over disputes about or arising out of employment agreements. And so that's been my experience. And so I've got a fair amount of experience looking at employment agreements from all sides, both in the drafting of them and then in the litigating of them if there's ever a dispute.
I always think that's one of the greatest parts about understanding your practice is both that you're not just drafting, you're not just looking at it from a corporate standpoint, but you're also taking into account what it looks like from a litigation perspective. So not only are you aware of when deals are occurring or when someone's in a buy-sell position, what's in a company's best interest, but also what happens when you need to enforce this agreement? What happens when you need to litigate the argument? So what are the courts holding? What are their feelings with regards to these types of agreements? And what will put a company into its best position moving forward by having an appropriately drafted employment agreement? I guess one of the first things I like to ask, and for some of our more seasoned listeners, this may seem way too fundamental, but what is an employment agreement?
Sure. Good question, and sometimes the simplest questions are the best. An employment agreement is simply an exchange of promises between an employer, usually a company, and a worker, an employee. It doesn't have to be in writing. It can be oral. And these promises are very simple. It's basically the employer saying, I agree to pay you to do a particular function, and the employee agrees to do that work in exchange for that money. So that's that at its core is the basis of an employment agreement. We recommend that employment agreements be written since it memorializes what the promises are between the employer and the employee. But that's basically it. And then the scope of the employment agreement can be as broad and detailed as the two parties agree. And so we'll talk a lot about what you can add to that basic exchange of promises.
So if during the course of an interview of an applicant, I tell the applicant that this job pays $18 an hour, that the hours of work are between 8 and 6, and that the end of the year, if they reach all their target sales, they'll get a $500 bonus, and the start date is, let's say, October 1st. Have I entered into a contract with that employee?
Correct. If the employee agrees to those terms, and the employee then starts to work to perform the services that are contemplated as part of that agreement, then you've got a contract.
So if, let's take it one step further, let's say that exact situation happens, right? The individual accepts my offer of employment and starts working, and I never memorialize something in writing. And at the end of the first month of work, the employee comes in and says, well, you told me I was being paid $20 an hour. What what's my problem, or what can I do, or do I have a problem, or do I just have an employee who can't listen?
Well, you may have a problem. What you have certainly is a disagreement as to the terms of the contract, which is why we recommend these things be in writing to avoid these sorts of differences of opinion as to what the agreement was. And if they can't agree, then the dispute may ultimately go to a court or arbitrator, who will then listen to the two parties' respective memories as to what the agreement was, and then decide who's more credible.
Oftentimes, especially small business owners will come to me and they'll say, I don't need any employment agreements. I just don't need them. And I think one of the things that I find most interesting is helping people to understand or recognize that they do need the things that they don't think that they need. And I think people think contract or agreement, lawyers, this is going to be just a complete waste of my time and a lot of money. And in order to have a good agreement, it's going to cost me, you know, thousands of dollars generally, right? Generally, however, if I took those terms that I had said orally to the employee and put it in writing on a piece of paper, and I signed it, and I asked the employee to accept those terms, that would be sufficient to create a contract that potentially would provide me some level of protection against any further future court proceeding or arbitration agreement in the situation we've discussed, correct?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, your example was a good one. When a company hires an employee and there's an oral agreement, and they come in and they start working in exchange for pay, you've got a contract. There's an employment agreement in place. It's just not written. And so to those employers who say, well, I don't want to deal with a contract or employment contracts, what they're really saying, although maybe they're not realizing it, they just don't want to deal with a written contract because they figure it's going to cost money to have a lawyer draft it. But in many respects, your example shows the vulnerability that kind of mentality presents, because if there's a dispute and there's nothing in writing, the employer's version may ultimately prevail, but can be very expensive to get to that ultimate resolution where a court or an arbitrator rules, maybe for the employer, maybe for the employee. And with respect to many of the issues in employment, especially wages, the stakes can get pretty high pretty fast, because the statutes that address the payment of wages allow for the recovery of attorney fees, which can often be the tail that wags the dog in these disputes, when you've got tens of thousands of dollars in attorney fees piling up in a dispute over what could be a very modest amount of wages, maybe only a few thousand dollars, but there's an incentive for lawyers to take these kinds of cases for employees just because the law allows for that generous recovery. Plus, there are various multiples that apply in the law, so the statute would multiply the unpaid wages, at least in Maine and many other states, by three. So if the dispute's over $1,000, in compensation, the statute would triple it if the employee ultimately wins. So employers really are not likely to be saving themselves any money in the long run by avoiding putting employment agreements in writing.
So oftentimes, one of the things that I hear when I'm talking to a client who doesn't have an agreement in writing is that they'll say, well, I don't have it in writing because I want to be able to fire this person whenever I want. Can you still have an employment agreement that a person or a company can fire the person whenever they want and still have an employment agreement with that person?
Absolutely. That's just one element of an employment agreement, is how it ends. And so that's, again, it's part of this buffet of options that parties can choose from to put into an employment agreement. And so we certainly recommend that the way that the parties can end the relationship be included in any agreement, any written agreement. And so employment at will is one way that employment can end. Namely, the employment at will just means that either party can terminate the employment at any time for any reason, and with generally, unless there's something else in the contract that limits this, with no notice. So as a practical matter, under most state laws, if you have an oral employment agreement, there's a presumption that the employment is at will. That presumption also applies to written employment agreements that are silent as to the term of the employment. So if there's nothing in the employment agreement that says how long the employee will be employed for, then the presumption is that it's at will. But it's always good to put that in the contract. And oftentimes we'll have a hybrid. You know, you could have a employment, a guaranteed employment period for, say, a year or 2 years, and then after that it rolls over to employment at will, unless either party or unless both parties agree to renew the agreement for a specific term.
Something that you mentioned earlier was with regards to wage payment and kind of the risks associated with not having a written agreement. Let's say that I, as a company, have an independent contractor agreement, right? Can I just take that and use it as my employment agreement?
I wouldn't recommend that. I think that, first of all, independent contractor agreements, by their very name, are non-employment agreements, and they are drafted in such a way as to clarify that the worker is not an employee, and therefore there's no obligation for the employer to do lots of things like make withholdings from the payment of compensation. There's no expectation with respect to any other employment, mandatory employment laws like training for sexual harassment and the like. And so it'd be important to the extent that you're going to take your independent contractor form, which certainly may have some elements that you can reuse in an employment agreement like compensation and termination of the relationship, and other things that we could cover later on, like confidentiality obligations and the like. But I would resist the urge to save a little money and just cross off the title of an independent contractor agreement and then repurpose it as an employment agreement.
I think another thing that it's important for our listeners to be aware of and understand is, in the same vein, you can't take an employment agreement and make it into an independent contractor agreement. And in previous episodes and discussions and blog posts, Verrill specifically has talked a lot about the importance of maintaining the guide of what independent contractor really is, that each state has a specific test that must be met in order for a provider of services to appropriately be classified as an independent contractor. As we're talking about what you can't do with an employment agreement, though, and what we don't recommend employers doing, let's talk about specifically what are some of the general provisions that we would likely see within an employment agreement. So if you want to give me a couple, and then let's talk about them.
Sure. So I referred to some of these early on in our talk. The first one is the agreement to hire somebody. And so typically that would have a start date, and you would refer to the start date. That's a good thing to put in there. When is the employment agreement effective? What's the position? Is there a title that goes with it? That can be helpful in terms of classifying the worker as exempt or non-exempt. Is this a managerial position or not? Another key term we touched on earlier was the term of the employment. Is this going to be at will, meaning either party can terminate the relationship at any time for any reason with or without notice? Or is this going to be a guarantee of employment for some period of time, a year, 2 years, 3 years? I think some employers think, well, of course, it's going to be at will. I want to have my flexibility to get rid of somebody. But as a practical matter, you may not be able to hire somebody that you really want unless you guarantee them some period of employment. If this is a really important worker and you need them, they may say, hey, I'm not, especially if they're moving or leaving a long-term job, they're going to, if they have any leverage and savvy, they'll want to have some guaranteed period of employment before they make the leap to a new employer. Another really important element of an employment agreement would be the duties. What are they going to do? What specifically is the scope of the employment relationship? And, you know, this is one of those things that overlaps with an independent contractor agreement. What are you hiring this person to do? And that can be very important later on if there's a dispute about the job performance and the employee is not living up to the employer's expectations. The employer may say, you know, this is not working out. I'm going to let you go. And if there's a dispute about the legitimacy of the employer's reasons, it's important for the employer to be able to go back to the duty section of the agreement to say, well, look, you were hired to do these three things, and you didn't perform these three things adequately. And in the absence of that clause, an employee can say, well, no, I never promised I would do those duties. I was supposed to be doing something else. And so the reason you're letting me go, you know, means we must be breaching the contract, especially if the employee articulates a reason that the employer is breaching the contract for some unlawful reason. It's because, you know, like, geez, I got sick. I had to take a medical leave. Maybe my age. That's why you're letting me go. So they've got an employment discrimination claim in the works. You know, having the duties clause in an employment agreement be spelled out gives the employer the ability to point to something specific in the defense of any kind of claim like that, to the extent that there's a performance reason for ending the employment relationship.
So I want to talk more about that generally, but I want to take a break first and then get back into a discussion about the duties aspect of an employment agreement. I'm Tawny Alvarez. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsInME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsInME.com. That's JobsInME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and our guest today is attorney Rob Brooks, and we're talking about employment agreements generally, what they are, why you need them, and areas that people get into trouble when they don't use employment agreements appropriately. We are just talking about setting forth the duties or the expectations that an employer has within an employment agreement. And I cut Rob short, and in part because I have some questions that I want to ask. Lots of times a client will say to me, I don't want to put the duties into the employment agreement, Tawny, because it's a new position and I'm not even sure at this point in time what I want them to do. Or isn't it okay if I just attach a job description? But if I attach the job description, can it evolve or can I change it? Or am I stuck with the job description that I have at the time in which I hire that individual? So I know I put a bunch of questions into that, you know, question, but I expect you to answer it anyway.
Sure, no worries. Well, it's a good question and a legitimate concern. And this question touches on the importance of a well-drafted employment agreement. So before we took a break, I was talking about the benefits of having a specific job description and how that job description can help an employer defend a claim that they're either breaching the contract when they terminate somebody or being unlawful in their activities when they deal with an employee, and the employer's reason for, say, terminating the employee is that they're not performing their job duties sufficiently. And so to avoid getting pinned down, and as you articulated the concern, which is legitimate, we recommend, and we certainly do when we draft employment agreements, include some language that says that the company has the ability to modify the job duties from time to time or as necessary to meet the company's legitimate business interests. And in some employment contracts, especially executive contracts, there's often some limitation on how much an employer can change the job duties, because if you're hiring an executive, say, to come in and do a sales role, perform a sales role, then that executive may say, well, I don't want you to give me a totally new job task like accounting, which I'm not qualified for, then he's, you know, you set me up to fail and you fire me, and then I'm out of work. So apart from those kinds of situations, having the ability to change the job duties as needed is important to include. You know, and again, we also encourage that the job description be attached to the agreement so that everybody knows what the expectations are, and it's memorialized in one self-contained agreement.
So you mentioned earlier an aspect of the duties test as being important to memorialize the party's expectations, but also in case you ever get into a situation in which you're going to start fighting about whether or not the duties have been appropriately performed, or if there is some kind of legal or legitimate reason why the duties aren't being performed, let's say a disability or an extended absence. Is there a way to take into account kind of those expectations with regards to the duties, but still say that the employer could terminate an individual if they were incapacitated for a period of time or unable to perform job duties or responsibilities?
Sure. And that's a great question. And when you're dealing with a disability in particular, you can certainly include a provision in an employment agreement. We typically do this for executive contracts. Yeah, in terms of how to deal with a disability. And one way to deal with these situations is you define what's a disability. You know, it could be a disability is something, any medical condition that keeps the employee from performing the material duties of their job for some certain period of time. Let's say it's 3 months out of a 6-month period. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to track federal or state law on disability leaves. And again, the parties can agree to their own terms for this, and it does hopefully it'll be tethered to the requirements of the job and the importance of the job. So the more important the job, like an executive employment contract, you may look at your business and say, well, geez, we really can't be without a CFO or a CEO or some other high level, you know, VP of marketing for any longer than 3 months or 2 months. The job's, you know, the job's so important that the business will really suffer if that key position is not filled. We typically don't do this for a lower level or mid level employment contract, however. So that's one way to handle disabilities. And also, again, with a more senior level employee employment contract where we're dealing with disabilities and the definition of a disability, we also like to include a way to resolve a dispute over whether somebody is or is not disabled. And that can be very helpful down the road if there ever is a disagreement as to whether somebody's disabled.
Okay, so we've talked about compensation, we've talked about duties, we've talked about the period of time in which the contract or the employment will be valid for. We've talked kind of generally about disability and the ability to maybe end the employment relationship. Are there other general terms in an employment contract that we should be considering?
Sure. Well, I'd like to talk more about compensation because in my experience, this is where most of the disputes come down to, is how much money is the employee owed and has the employer paid it. And so
I don't think anyone's going to be surprised to hear that money is at the root of the issue.
it's the gateway to the resolution of the dispute, even if the dispute's over disability or termination with or without cause. And, you know, it's okay, you got to pay me all you owe me on my way out the door. And so the compensation provision is the one place where drafters and employers really want to spend some time to think about what they're putting in writing, and is it clear? Will a third party, like a judge or an arbitrator, understand what the parties agreed to? And unfortunately, a lot of employers and employees, when they enter into these agreements, they're full of optimism and they never think that there'll ever be a dispute. So they just quickly, you know, come to some agreement on the amount of money that the employee is going to get paid, and everybody's hopeful that, yeah, these bonus provisions that we've got in here are going to be great. We're all going to make tons of money. And then something happens, things go off the rails, and there's a dispute. And that's the point where the parties and then their lawyers have to look at something, and they look at the agreement. And if it's not clear, then each party can have their own interpretation, and then it goes off potentially to a judge or jury, and that's not always a good place to be. Certainly very expensive to go through that process. So what are the elements of compensation? So base salary, that's typically pretty simple. How much are you paying people for the year? is typically how we set that. But it could be a weekly salary, it could be a monthly. And
some people get concerned that if they put what the yearly salary is, it seems to be creating an assumption that whole year increments will create employment, if that makes sense. So I've talked to people who said, I don't want to put what the yearly salary is because I'm afraid a judge or you lawyers who just read into everything so minutely will presume that by me saying what the yearly salary is, I was promising to employ that individual for a whole year. Is that concern valid?
Generally not. I mean, I think most courts and arbitrators and looking at an agreement, we'll look at the whole agreement and see what the context is. And if you've got a compensation section that says, well, I'm paying somebody $100,000 a year, and then there's another section that says that either party can terminate the contract at any time for any reason or no reason, you know, let's say they're 2 months into the year, that most arbitrators are not going to say, geez, you owe them $100,000. They basically say that's 2 months worth of compensation. However, you can use such words if you're drafting these things, words like annualized salary or pro rata basis, or you put in a clause that says if you're terminated, that you get paid your pro rata salary through the date of termination. So there are ways to address that the potential ambiguity where a crafty lawyer would try to slide in and make an argument that the employee is entitled to more money than the parties contemplated. But in terms of base salary, it's also useful to address how are you going to handle increases or decreases. So if you want to, let's say you're hiring a new employee, it's a new position, you're not sure about them, you perhaps want to put in a clause that says this is not a floor, that there is potential that salary could be decreased, and that we'll look at your salary every year or as often as the company thinks is appropriate and decide whether you're going to get an increase or decrease. And that's something to take into account as well. Then the other things to think about with compensation are bonuses and other additional compensation. So if you have people who are paid on an incentive basis or in whole or in part, that's really important to nail down with specificity. You know, in particular, things like how is the bonus going to be earned? When is it going to be earned? How is it going to be vested? And especially, what happens when the employee leaves? How much of that money do they get, if any? And so if the employer wants to be able to not pay any of the incentive comp when somebody leaves, it should say clearly in the agreement that the employee is not entitled to any compensation, any of this like additional compensation when they leave, or other or whatever restrictions they want to put in there. But that's the place where we typically see fights. And the remedies I was talking about earlier over unpaid wages apply equally in pretty much every single state to this additional compensation, bonuses, commissions, and the like. And so the potential exposure to companies for failure to pay bonuses is the same for failure to pay a base salary. And that would include attorney fees and triple damages or double damages, depending on the state you're in.
I think that's important for listeners to understand, is because I think oftentimes they say, well, here's the bonus plan. You get 5% of the revenues that you generate. And that in and of itself should be sufficient because it's going to lead the salesperson to increase their sales. We're happy. We're not losing anything. But the problem becomes is it based off of when the sale is made? Is it based off of when the payment's made by the client? Does the individual have to be employed at that time? These are all things that we want companies and employers to be considering when they are going through this process or memorializing what the compensation aspects are.
Right.
So outside of compensation, what are some other terms that we would regularly see within an employment agreement?
Boy, there's, like I said, there's a big buffet of elements or components that are available for inclusion in an employment agreement. One thing that's typical would be business expenses. What kind of expenses will the company reimburse the employee for? What expenses aren't going to be reimbursed? And that's often a source of contention.
I find this specifically with regards to a professional setting, things such as licensing fees or travel reimbursement, or if there's an expectation that conferences are attended or speaking engagements are performed, setting forth very clearly what the company's expectation is, both for their participation in those events, mm-hmm. but also what percentage of reimbursement will be provided. And I'm guessing you're going to get into it shortly, is that paid time? Is vacation time permitted? How is that used from a paid time off, vacation, personal time standpoint?
Yeah. Well, those are all great points. And often those kinds of clauses with respect to vacation and continuing education, they can often be addressed in an employee handbook, which can be referenced in the employment agreement. You know, this employment agreement says, you know, that the benefits that we offer concerning those issues are contained in the employee handbook, which will then have its own clause that says the employer can change these at any time. So you can incorporate things in just to keep the size of these employment contracts from getting too big.
Does that create any problems when our employee handbook very clearly sets forth that it's not an employment contract? So we're saying our employee handbook is not an employment contract, but then we're taking a contract and we're referencing the handbook. By doing that, am I creating a handbook that truly is a contract?
I think not. I mean, what you have an employment contract, which is a contract. And by incorporating the employee handbook, what you've done is that the parties have agreed that the employer has some discretion in certain areas to change things, change the arrangement. So that, again, this agreement, the employment agreement, that gives the employer the discretion, the freedom to modify certain terms. And so by incorporating an employee handbook, for instance, that's one example.
In the same vein, likely you're going to offer health or other forms of welfare benefits. You're not going to take the full plan documents and put them within the employment contract, but instead are going to reference those plan documents when you're talking about the health or welfare benefits that an individual will be provided, correct?
That's right. And that's typical in these agreements. In employment agreements, is that the employee is eligible to participate in the various benefit plans that the company offers according to the terms of those plans. And that's very common language. And again, another example of how a contract can incorporate other provisions whereby the employer has some flexibility to change things.
We're going to take a break, but when we return, I really want to start talking about ways in which we can use employment agreements to provide other protections to the company, such as to protect its confidential agreements or to otherwise protect assets within the company. So, you're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on JobsNME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit JobsNME.com. That's JobsNME.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Life's never perfect, but as realtors, we know living it in the perfect place can make a big difference.
Imagine
hiding from your screeching children in that spacious walk-in closet, watching the neighbor's dog poop on the freshly sodded grass you negotiated during closing, dropping your cell phone in the toilet of the spa-like five-piece bathroom again. So get the perfect place to house all of life's imperfections. Get Realtor. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, and our guest today is attorney Rob Brooks, a partner in Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. We've spent most of this episode discussing employment agreements generally, and we've only touched the surface on many of the different provisions an individual would want to include in any employment agreement. Before the break, I told our listeners that we were going to come back and really get into the nitty-gritty regarding confidentiality agreements, non-compete agreements, and non-solicitation provisions. Now, I've kind of gone back and forth here, Rob, and I've said a non-compete agreement or a confidentiality agreement. Can these be separate and distinct agreements, or is there place as a provision within an employment agreement more generally?
The answer is a confidentiality agreement, also called an NDA or non-disclosure agreement, a non-competition agreement, non-solicitation agreement, those can all be standalone agreements, or they could be incorporated into an employment agreement. And then a hybrid approach is in the employment agreement, there's a clause that says the employee agrees to comply with the non-disclosure and non-competition and non-solicitation agreement that is attached to this agreement as Exhibit A or B or whatever letter you want to give to it. So you incorporate those two agreements into one agreement.
So maybe surprisingly, as attorneys, here we are saying there's not just one right way to do it. There are a multitude of different ways in which we can reach the end goal here. But what is the end goal? I think maybe we should start at the beginning. Why would I want, let's start with a confidentiality agreement within an employment agreement. Does every employer need it, or do only people who are working in the sciences or high tech areas or need or want those type of agreements?
Well, I think the need for employees to sign non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality agreements will depend on two things: the nature of the employer's business, and then the duties of that employee. And so with respect to non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality agreements, those sorts of agreements tend to be given to employees at every level in the company, or almost every level in the company, because in many businesses, any employee can have access to the company's confidential data and trade secrets. Whether it's a senior executive or a mid-level manager, a clerk, or someone who's taken out the garbage. Any one of those people can have a thumb drive in their pocket, and if they have access to a computer, they can plug it in and download all kinds of sensitive data, or they can pull out all kinds of sensitive paper. You know, so the need for all employees to sign a confidentiality agreement is such that, at least in most businesses, those sorts of agreements typically are standalone agreements, and every employee will sign them as they come in. And so they're less often to be incorporated into an employment agreement.
I think it's important that we're really clear with listeners, however, as well, is that let's take financial information. Let's say that you work for a sandwich restaurant, and at your sandwich restaurant, you want to protect the financial data of your organization, right? Confidential information wouldn't be the price that you charge for a turkey sandwich, but it might be what your sales are over the course of a day, month, or year, what your cost is for buying that turkey, and then how you choose to price what the turkey sandwich is. So maybe what your markup is, and if you have a specific equation that you're going to use based off of the cost of the goods that go into making this sandwich, and then you say you mark it up 15% or 12%, what is your revenue? That's the confidential information we're talking about. But if it's information that's generally known to the public, stuff that you're marketing, that's not confidential data. And I think sometimes employers forget that they still have to limit what is considered or can be put under that confidentiality umbrella.
That's right. We typically will draft these provisions fairly broadly, say any information that is not generally known to the public. And then if there's a dispute later on with an employee, there's a judgment call that's made by the employer and their lawyers as to how far are we going to push this. You know, so that, like, for the salesperson, they may say they have taken the customer list, and we, you know, we'll say that's our secret customer list, and the salesperson will say, "Well, geez, I just use the phone book, and the phone book's not confidential." So that's where, again, we have to get into the details about what information is truly confidential and adds value to the business by virtue of being confidential. And another thing that's quite important to keep in mind with these kinds of clauses is, what steps does the employer take to keep that information confidential? Do they make employees sign non-disclosure agreements, for instance? Do they keep this information locked up or in a secure area on the server? You know, and the more things that the company does to keep this information secret, and the more they can show that there's a value to the by keeping this information secret, the more likely they will be able to enforce that kind of non-disclosure agreement.
So let's jump now to non-solicitation provisions. And for our listeners who are unaware, non-solicitation provisions come in two formats specifically, I think we see most often. One, non-solicitation of customers or clients. And then second, non-solicitation of employees. Let's jump into non-solicitation of customers or clients. What type of provisions can an employer include that would likely be held up in a court? And I know that's an unfair question because every jurisdiction, every court is going to have a different standard. But what's your recommended kind of language that you feel comfortable providing?
Well, I think the basic place to start with what's a reasonable non-solicitation clause, and this also applies for non-competition clauses, which we can get to in a minute, is what's reasonable for the business to protect its legitimate interest. And so that's a very fact-based evaluation. One thing I can tell you that's not reasonable is just trying to protect a monopoly or to inhibit competition. Most courts view that as inappropriate and unreasonable and will not allow that agreement to be enforced in that way. And so the non-solicitation clauses will typically be drafted in a way to be reasonable or to meet this reasonableness test that are limited in the amount of time that they're going to apply. So it's 6 months, a year, 2 years. Again, this depends on the kind of business. Another limitation would be a geography restriction, you know, customers within a certain radius, or although that's more common for non-competition. And then also the definition of who's a customer. You know, is it an active customer or one who's done business with you in the last 6 months, or is it a potential customer, or is it a customer that with whom the employee did business? You know, I say did business, actually contacted, you know, or is it the company's entire customer list? And so the more tailored the limitation is to protect that employer's legitimate interest, the more likely it is to be enforced.
The last two things that I want to talk about, interestingly enough, are two topics that arguably we could each talk about for an hour apiece. And the fact that I've only left us with a couple minutes to discuss it, I know is difficult, but I do want to just give everyone a flavor for these issues. And the first one is non-compete clauses. What is a non-compete clause? Something that you can just put together without talking to an attorney, or is that something you're really going to want to spend a little money on?
I think non-competition clauses are another version of what we call a restrictive covenant, namely something that limits an employee's ability to do certain things after they leave. So we talked about non-solicitation of employees, non-solicitation of customers. We talked about restrictions on the use of company information after they leave. And non-competition agreements are another version, namely the employees agreeing not to even be in the business, in the industry or the field in which they were working for the company. And those tend to be harder to enforce, but they can be appropriate in some circumstances. And so, as with a non-solicitation agreement, they have to be drafted reasonably or designed to protect a legitimate business interest. In the state of Maine, and in many other states, but Maine specifically, in the month of September 2019, we have a new law going into effect that limits the use of non-competition agreements to certain circumstances, namely employees who are earning less than 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about $49,000, cannot enter into a non-competition agreement as a matter of law. If you have employees who are paid more than that, who are going to be subject to a non-competition agreement, then the employer has to give them advance notice of the non-competition agreement before they're hired, and give them at least 3 days to review the agreement before they are made to sign it. And then the effective date for these non-competition agreements is that they can't be effective until 1 year after the employment starts or 6 months after the agreement is signed, whichever is later, which is a pretty significant change in the way we do things in Maine anyway.
So I think it's clear that this is a very specialized and specific area. Multiple states, California, Massachusetts, a number of other states also have significant and similar restrictions. I'm going to cut us off there with regards to confidentiality, non-compete, and non-solicitation agreements. You're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be back after this short break.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
We're back, and you're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tawny Alvarez, and our guest today is attorney Rob Brooks, and we've been talking about employment agreements, what they are, when you need them, restrictive covenants that you can use to protect your company's assets. This last section, I want to talk about arbitration agreements. Anyone who has been in human resources for any period of time has heard the back and forth between arbitration agreements. Should we have them? Shouldn't we have them? Are they enforceable in an employment agreement? Is it just lawyers' way to rack up the bills? Rob, give me the quick and dirty on this.
Okay. Just by way of background, an arbitration agreement is merely an agreement between the employer and the employee, or any two parties for that matter, to have what essentially is a private dispute resolution, one that is outside of the public court system. So instead of using a judge who's paid by the state or federal government, you're using a private individual who's agreed to by the parties, who will undertake a trial essentially in private. And so the public doesn't get to see what's happening like they would with a public dispute in the courts. And so the rules that apply to the arbitration are up to the parties. You can incorporate rules from various sources, like the American Arbitration Association is one source, and they have a whole set of rules that looks something like the kinds of rules you'd see in a court system. But with the private arbitration system, the arbitrator is paid for it by the parties as opposed to the taxpayers for the court system. And so this whole system is generally viewed as faster and less expensive, and then, of course, private. And so those are three reasons why many employers like arbitration. Of course, there are exceptions to those perceptions of speed and and low cost. Arbitrations can drag on for a long time. It can be very expensive, and in some cases more expensive than if you'd just gone to court in the first instance. And so most companies actually perceive, however, that arbitration is more fair to them. There's no jury trial, so you take away the risk of a runaway jury of people who have it in for corporations and want to look at it for the little guy. Most arbitrators are lawyers, although the best ones tend to be professional arbitrators who do nothing else except just hear cases. So they tend to have a reputation to protect as being fair and reasonable. In that way, they'll ensure they get picked again in the future. And so the arbitration has been in the news a lot in the last several years. There's been some pretty well-publicized decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, one of which upheld the right of an arbitration agreement to have the employee in the employment context waive their right to join a class action. And that was welcome news to the employer community, which has been targeted by class action lawsuits recently, especially in the wage and hour context. But we see them also in discrimination for sex, age, race, et cetera. And so that's perceived to be a huge advantage to prevent employees from banding together and forming a class. And so most large companies in this country, the vast majority, actually it's over 60%, I believe, maybe 70%, require employees to sign arbitration agreements as a condition of employment. And if you're not using an arbitration agreement, you should be asking yourself, why not? And then at least undertake the evaluation as to whether it makes sense for your business.
Rob, thank you so much for this very educational program today. You've been listening to HR Power Hour, and you've been listening to Rob Brooks, an attorney at Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. I'm Tani Alvarez. This is News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Until next week, have a great day.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VerrillDana.com.
So, how much money did you make at your last job?
Nope.
Hi, I'm Ben Ford from Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. In response to the yawning wage gap between men and women, equal pay acts are sweeping the country. It's always been illegal to pay one gender less than another for the same job, but gender pay acts go a little further by addressing the systemic issues involved in forcing the gap. Anchoring a salary expectation to a prior job is one of those systemic issues. So, many states, including Connecticut, California, Massachusetts, and now Maine, have enacted some form of prohibition from using salary history in making hiring decisions. Not only can you not ask about salary in the hiring process, you shouldn't ask about earning history until after you've made an offer and the salary for the position has been negotiated and settled. Got a question about equal pay? Call Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerrillDana.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.